Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. I'm going to take a hiatus from this show in a few weeks for the first time in 17 years. I need to focus on some other projects, including a book I'm writing, and I won't be able to afford the time to produce and host this show pro bono. But before I take this break, I want to try a few different formats. So today, I will be the guest. And Sarah Davidson, best-selling author of Loose Change and Leap, whose new book, The December Project, comes out in March, will be interviewing me. I've long thought it's only fair that I have to answer a few questions, and today it's finally going to happen. Here in Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Sarah Davidson is the best-selling author of 8 books, including Loose Change, Three Women of the 60s, Joan, 40 Years of Life, Loss, and Friendship with Joan Didion, and Leap, What Will We Do with the Rest of Our Lives? She's written more than 150 articles and essays in The New York Times Magazine, Newsweek, Harper's, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, and was a successful television writer, creating 2 series and winning a Golden Globe nomination for her work on Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. I'm sure a lot of my bio will come out in Sarah's interview. Welcome back to Free Forum, Sarah Davidson.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay. Now, as I said, I'm turning the tables, but before I do, I want people to know just a little bit more about the person on the other side. So tell briefly what to expect in your upcoming book, which I said will be out towards the end of March, The December Project.
A few years ago, I got a call from a rabbi who lives where I do in Boulder, Colorado, named Zalman Schachter Shalomi. But he is beloved by hundreds of thousands of people as Reb Zalman. He founded the Jewish Renewal Movement. He's colorful, brilliant. And though he's an Orthodox rabbi, he's led a very unorthodox life. And he said to me, I want to have a series of talks with you about what I'm calling the December Project. When you can feel in yourselves that you're coming to the end of your tour of duty, what is the spiritual work of this time and how do we prepare for the mystery? Well, I wasn't really thinking much about mortality, but I jumped at the chance to spend time with him, and for 2 years we met every Friday to talk about this and hundreds of other things. And the book is a memoir about those conversations, and interspersed with it are sketches from his extraordinary life.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to you, Sarah.
Great. Now, Terrence, you've been doing this show for 17 years, talking about a world that just might work. I don't get it. To me, the world is imperfect and always will be. That's its nature. Life is imperfect. As John F. Kennedy once said, life is not fair. So what is a world that works, and why do you qualify it with the words, just might?
Well, the just might part is really critical. You can imagine when I say this to people, they say, well, why not just a world that works? Come on.
Yeah.
You know, go all the way, guy. And my feeling is that I somewhat hold to what you said, you know, in asking the question, that may not be possible. But the just might, what it really is it's an invitation and a challenge. In other words, it's probably not working so good right now, but it just might. And it really, it's just one thing I said one day when I was probably introducing the show or describing something, and I sort of went, that's really how I feel. So the just might means if. It's for those of grammarians out there, it's the subjunctive. and the subjunctive has to do with wish and possibility and that sort of thing. And so it just might work if you do your part and if everyone else listening does their part and if things fall together. But at least it comes from the point of view of we've got a shot. But it's not going to happen passively, and it's not going to happen if we're spectators, and it's not going to happen if we're blaming. And it's really about, as I say, an invitation to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work. And what do I mean by it? It has to do with justice. It has to do with fairness. It has to do with inclusion. It has to do with possibility. A couple of things that we lose sight of really very often in this culture, which is seeing the long-term view, seeing the relationships in which things happen, seeing beyond your family or your company or your neighborhood or your religion or your political party. And so it's the world that I envision that just might work is one in which we see things differently and approach them with an eye to making it work.
Okay, I sort of get it. I'm curious, when did you first feel a call to repair the world? How did that develop in you?
Oh, my God. I think it's been with me a long time. I assume probably strains of it were there before college, but I would say definitely during college. When I say strains of it, I graduated high school and entered college in 1965, smack dab.
Oh, no, you hit it a sweet spot of the 60s cultural and political revolution. But before then, I want to go back a minute to before you got to college, which was Harvard. You grew up mostly in Florida, in a Catholic family of six children. Mm-hmm. You were number two, but you were the oldest boy. What was your role in the family?
Well, I was going to get to that, actually, because what my role in the family was I was, there's no black sheep in our family, but I was the rebel, I was the questioner, I was the pain in the butt to my parents, for sure. Now, I will give myself this context, is that my mother and father were typical of a lot of people, married just before he went overseas for World War II. She was 18, he was 20, Marcella and Edward. And when he came back, he had been attending Suffolk. He dropped out of Suffolk, a small college in Boston, went in the service. When he came back, the GI Bill and good work on his part got him into Harvard. He attended Harvard also on the GI Bill. Now, the thing that was interesting was he dropped out a couple of times to take care of the family. And he ended up graduating at the age of 29 with three kids already.
Wow.
So what I saw in him was sort of the weight of all of that and the inability to take risks and, you know, if you get just that position. Now, my mother was, again, as so many women of that era, a mother of three at that point and then three more as they were Catholics and you know what they call couples who practice the rhythm method, parents, well, in our case, it was six times over, you know. And I just know that they were under enormous stress. Mm. And the way that they chose to handle that stress, I think, was to, in this world they couldn't control economically and all of these things, they wanted to control the family. So there were lots of rules. And as I could see then, and I think even I would see now, a lot of unreasonable rules. And that didn't work for little Terrence. Little Terry, actually. But when he was in trouble, it was little Terrence. But so I was the one that said, wait a minute, it's not really raining. Why can't I go out? You know, wait a minute, you know, it's not really... That's not really happening. Why can't I, you know, all of these things. And so that was my role in the family. And it's interesting, the last three came through a different family, I think. When my mom went to work, as the latter children got to be one and two, my grandmother moved in with us after her husband passed away. And she would take care of the kids. My mom went to work. And she became much less of a, you know, much less authoritarian at home once she had the world to deal with. Mm. But in those early years, my sister was sort of keep quiet. My younger brother, sister 2 years older, brother 2 years younger, he was, let's make things all work out. And I was, you know, wait a minute.
The challenger.
Yeah, I was the challenger. So what I see actually is that is a piece that is carried with me throughout, that I challenge and that I sort of see the authority figures as making no sense. And the authority figures have lived up to that, so it's been easy to keep that going.
Yes. Now, Terrence, you went to Catholic schools and then public high school in Cocoa, Florida, and then you went to Harvard. How did you get in? Today, it's like winning the lottery getting into Harvard.
Yeah. My stepson went through this whole process. He's a sophomore at Oberlin, but he went through this whole process 2 years ago. And, you know, I got into it more deeply than I had in a few years, of course, and it is ridiculous. I would not get in today. I think I can tell you a couple of things. One was, although my father ended up, you know, not being a big contributor, I think the legacy makes a little piece of it. I did great on test scores, national merit and SATs and that sort of thing. I did quite well in school, but I was not, I did not have that exceptional something. You know, the violinist who wins the contest, the athlete, the scientist who comes up with, you know, all those things that we see little TED Talks about nowadays. I was, you know, I was better than average. But I will tell you this little story. My best friend in high school and I, he had also moved to Cocoa from New York via Miami. And it was that period where Cocoa was right adjacent to Cape Canaveral. So that's why people were moving there. It was the fastest growing area in the country for a few years.
Which we should tell younger people is now Cape Kennedy, or has it gone back to Cape Canaveral?
I think the city went back to Cape Canaveral, but the base is still Cape Kennedy. But people know that's where the space program was happening when I moved there in 1963 to 65. It was right in the middle. Remember, we put the man on the moon in 69. But so my buddy Johnny Waxman and I, we applied to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and we took our local interviews with local folks in the Cocoa Orlando area because that's what you did. So I never visited a college or anything, you know, and so we went to them.
No,
by
nobody did in those
that's,
days.
That's right. We went together. Well, the Harvard interview, he goes in first, I go in second, we get in our car, we're driving back home, and he says, so what kind of questions did he ask you? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he asked me about Winston Churchill's role in World War II, and he asked me what my favorite play was. And I said, you know what? Mostly he talked about how his preppy roommate set the curtains on fire. And I'm telling you, this is the truth. He asked me no substantive questions, but he had a good time. And I learned at that moment, because when we would, you know, freshmen at Harvard would go, why did you get in? Why did you get in? And I go, I think it's the interview. So it's funny that on that side of the interview, I thought it was what got me in here. And now I am doing interviews every week on the radio.
I think having fun is critical.
Yep.
And makes a lasting impression. So you arrive at Harvard in 1965. Can you describe what it was like then? And by the way, that's when I arrived in Boston. I'm a few years older than you, and it was my first job as a reporter for the Boston Globe.
Oh, I didn't even realize that we shared that. So you'd been at Berkeley, then you'd been at Columbia Journalism, and the job was in Boston.
My first job was in Boston in 1965.
Okay.
So what was Harvard like then?
Well, I'll tell you the contrast between what Harvard was like and also what I was like. I arrived at Harvard with a flat top.
I know.
And the sort of the clothing at my high school, which I think was pretty normal everywhere, was, you know, like Oxford shirts and khaki slacks and Weegans if you could get them. And that was, you know, Madras shirts. And that's what I arrived being. Now, I will tell you that I think the first day I got there, I walked to my dorm, and in my dorm was a very small, old, creaky dorm in the yard, and they had entryways, so you'd have six suites around a set of stairs on one side, six suites around a set of stairs on the other side. That was our whole dorm. And so I arrive and I meet the guys who sit in, who live in the suite below me on the first floor, and they include Al Gore and Tommy Lee Jones. And that's like within my first 5 minutes, kind of walking towards my room, that's who I meet. So, I mean, it was like, whoa. And those guys, you know, I knew one of them was the son of a senator. And Tommy Lee Jones was as intimidating as a freshman at Harvard. He had a charisma, a sort of a dark charisma about him that was true from the moment you met him. You know, his dad worked on oil rigs in West Texas. He was a character. But the other thing I would say is within a short time, I saw a sign on a tree, you know, tacked to a tree that said Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who had recently, I think not the year before, but fairly recently been fired by Harvard for their experiments with LSD, were going to speak at, you know, it wasn't a university event, but there was the sign. And so 4 days after I get there, I go to Phillips Brooks house, and I climb upstairs to this room, and it's like I walked into the 60s. You know? In other words, the acolytes to Leary and Alpert are sitting there already. It's you know, they look different. Their hair is different. The room is different. What they're talking about is different. And I always sort of think, you know, not that that moment changed my life, but it just is such a – captures so well the contrast between me and Harvard. But I will say one other thing. Harvard evolved a great deal in the 4 years I was there as well. In other words, I was not atypical my freshman year. What I saw around Harvard in 65, the biggest impression that was made on me was by the preppies. You know, at that point, there was still a high percentage who were from Andover and Exeter and Riverdale. And I just remember going, who are these pasty-faced, you know, unhealthy? I don't think I knew the word entitled, but they're so confident, you know. Wow. Who are they? And I had a very tough time my first semester. I think I made mostly C's, and it was absolutely a struggle. Mm-hmm. And my second semester, I kind of hit my stride. And I will tell you one quick one. The roommate who my freshman year was my bunkmate, we were in bunk beds, was a kid from Towson. And if he's listening, Steve McDaniel, you were a great kid. But he within 5 minutes of meeting him, I knew he had 3 800s on his SATs.
Uh-huh.
And he almost flunked out freshman year. I mean, it was a brutal thing. And the basic point is that I think it upset everyone. You know, no one could live up to their own expectations. But I slowly and surely, you know, kind of figured out what was going on there. And then Harvard, as I say, Harvard's changes matched my own. And so by the end of my time there, I was taking independent studies and tutorials and starting a school and doing, you know, basically creating my own curriculum and doing very, very well.
And were you radicalized in terms of politics? How did you, what were your politics when you arrived and what were they when you graduated?
Interesting. I will tell you another story just to set what my politics were. And let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, and if you're confused, so am I. I am actually the interview subject today, and I'm being interviewed by Sarah Davidson, the best-selling author of Change and Leap, who has another book, December Project, coming out soon. The summer between my junior and senior year in high school, I went to Boys State. I don't think that gets nearly the press that it does now, but if people can remember when Bill Clinton was elected, they showed a picture of him shaking Kennedy's hand when he was 16. Bill Clinton had gone to Boys State, Arkansas, and then the very best of Boys State went to Boys Nation, and that's when he met Kennedy. But Boys State was a thing where they chose in Florida. It was 540 of the best boys in school for whatever, however they chose them. And they go to the capital of the state and they do a mock government. First, you run for city council and then you run for county and then you run for state. And finally, the last day or so, we elect the governor and it's a big deal. And I got there and I kind of looked around and I don't know what happened, but an early yippie thing hit me. And when you came into Boys State, you got either a yellow card that said you were a Nat nationalist or a green card that said you were a Federalist. And I went and got one of each, cut them down the middle.
Did you purposely do that?
Yes. And I put them on and I combined them so that my party was the Nads. Now, this is juniors in high school. You can imagine that when it came to cheering for my party, go Nads.
With your cheering squad of one.
No. Believe me, you start cheering gonads. And juniors get excited. So I would, before assemblies, people would get up and they'd go, you know, yay Federalists, yay, you know, nationalists. And then I'd get up and I'd go, gonads, and people would scream. So the point I'm making is that I wasn't conventionally either. But the darker point is that it wasn't until years later, Sarah, that I realized, I mean, I don't know whether it was 1 year, 2 years, that I realized there wasn't a single African-American in those 540. I was wise enough to know this Boys State, which was basically run by the American Legion and pumping up the Vietnam War at the time. You know, it was, you know, whatever word I can't say on Pacifica, it was that. And I could see through that and I made fun of it. But I couldn't see the next level down, which was that it was racist and that I was part of that. So that may give you a sense, okay? Now, I had also, I'd been very influenced by The Making of the President, 1960. That book is one of my, you know, as
a... By Joe McGinnis, was it?
No, that was Theodore H. White. Theodore H. White. And that book really got me. And so I was, at that point, probably a Kennedy-type Democrat. As a matter of fact, I was involved in the Young Dems my first year. My second year, people wanted me to run for president. The president my freshman year was a Roosevelt, if you can imagine.
This is at Harvard.
This is at Harvard, right. And my sophomore year, instead of running, I managed my roommate's campaign, and he won. And soon after that, I left the Young Dems and went further left. You know, I didn't ever actually, I mean, I don't think you had to join SDS, you know. I don't think there was a joining, but I certainly moved in that direction.
So you were radicalized. You moved to the left from the Young Democrats, would you say?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the whole school did it not?
Yeah, I'm 69. So, my senior year was the year of the takeover of University Hall and the strike of the university. And I was actually teaching that day at the high school that I had helped start. And when I came back to campus, the building had already been taken over. I went inside and was in the building when the Massachusetts police arrived at about 5 in the morning the next morning. So again, I wasn't one who took the building. But I was in the building, and I will confess, there were two main entries to University Hall, and I was lined up so that I was in the front of this crowd. We had hands held and, hair tied back and that sort of thing, ready for them to come in. And they tried my side first with their battering ram, and it didn't break our chains. And they went around to the other door first, came in the opposite side. I turned around when they came in. They didn't say anything. They just started hitting people with their billy clubs. And me and a friend who is still one of my best friends to this day both looked at each other and jumped out the window.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yeah, well, I can relate to that. and I think people who were listening to this maybe don't understand that that was a time when there were takeovers of buildings at all the major universities. It started at Berkeley with the free speech movement, where I went to college, where they sat down and took over the administration building. They even sat down around a police car, so the police car was immobilized. This was the primary way that students expressed their grievances and their demands for change, and it happened at Columbia University. And
Cornell was big.
Yes, and many other colleges. So, and I also, when I was participating, I also declined to get arrested.
Yeah. I mean, had they come in that front door, the story would be different, but they came in the other door, I took my option.
Yes. So tell me about your graduation from Harvard.
Oh,
your family came?
My family came up.
Cocoa, Florida?
That's right. They drove up. They also had relatives in New Bedford where I'd been born, and so they made a trip of it. They brought me up to college as a freshman, my mom and dad and I, and then for my graduation, them. And at least one of my brothers and sisters, I don't think they brought the youngest. Well, I was not the only one, but a number of us walked out of the commencement speech at one point. I don't know, 100, out. I guess the class was probably 1,000. I would think 100, 150, something like that, and got up en masse, walked out of the graduation ceremony and went across the street. And my dad and my mother stayed in the audience, but my dad and my younger brother followed and sort of said, how are you doing? Why'd you do that?
Did you do that?
Well, I think...
Why did the group do that?
The strike had been settled, or we wouldn't be holding commencement, but it was still a statement that we didn't... It was still a protest statement against the war, against the university's complicity with the war.
The war in Vietnam.
The war in Vietnam. And we had ROTC on campus. By the way, ROTC has returned to Harvard in the last year or two for the first time since then. As a result of our protest, Harvard pulled out of the ROTC program, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, which is where people go to college while they're also training for the service and so on. And one of our big points was that that shouldn't happen. So there were still things going on. I remember, by the way, that same year, commencement speech at Wellesley was given by Hillary Clinton, and it was very much an anti-war speech. And my girlfriend at the time,
Hillary Clinton was a student giving the...
She was, yes. Yes.
She was giving the valedictory in
the
address.
Yeah, exactly. But her speech was a very strong anti-war speech, you know, at that same – probably that same week. Let me tell people again, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, normally the host and interviewer. Today, the host and subject of the interview. I'm being interviewed by Sarah Davidson, the best-selling author of Loose Change and Leap, whose next book, The December Project, comes out in March.
So you were talking about it being a protest and it going on all across the country. But today, I think people would think, you got into Harvard, you graduated, and you walked out of your graduation. They just, young people just would find that inexplicable.
No, I'll question that. My guess is that we might not get, obviously we've had wars going on. And I don't think we've had we haven't had the kinds of protest that we had. But I do think that you would get a certain number who would act that way. A great deal has changed, I think, about college and about the prospects that students face coming out of college. We talked about how it's harder to get in, so they're already on some sort of crazy competitive track before they get in. But because of the student loans and that situation, basically my feeling is we're creating through that student loan system kind of a population of young serfs who graduate with these degrees they've been working for since they were 12 and loans that are in the $50,000, $100,000, $120,000, and they can't take the risk. They can't buck the system. They can't explore. And yet, there's a lot of them that do and will. But it's a much tougher stream they're swimming against. Also, the middle class was, as you and I know, was never stronger than right at that period. We were protesting. It was in some sense a luxury. We've talked about this many times on this program, but the middle class, helped by the GI Bill, helped by the housing loans, helped by the powerful unions in the country, the middle class was at its absolute best. Most of us will chart the beginning of the end of the middle class or the starvation of the middle class to the mid-70s, the Lewis Powell memo and those sorts of things. But this moment from 65 to 69 was when middle-class people could do well. Students could assume they would have a chance to travel, experiment, and still do well. And I was lucky enough to be one of those.
Yes. And you also, from the beginning of your time at Harvard, you were part of some social and educational experiments. Could you talk briefly about that?
Yeah, briefly. I'll try. I notice I don't do briefly real well.
We have a lot we want to cover. So.
That's right. I will have more sympathy on my guests from now on when I'm sitting rolling my eyes and going, when does this answer stop? Okay. Again, I was very lucky while I was in college. I was on scholarship and I was working. And my work my sophomore year was as an assistant to a teacher at a school, a little private school for problem kids. That is, kids who either had learning problems or emotional problems in Cambridge. And I used to walk down there in the mornings and teach, assist a teacher 2 or 3 days a week. At the end of that year, the administrator of the school asked me if I wanted to replace that teacher. So this is crazy. I'm a sophomore going into my junior year, and he asked me if I want to teach full-time next year while I'm going to Harvard or maybe take a year off. And I debated for a little while, and I decide that I will continue in school. I was afraid if I dropped out, I might not go back. It was that kind of times where, I'd take a road and end up a long distance away. So my junior year, I taught full-time at this school for, as I say, kids with various kinds of problems from 8 to 2, and then took a full load of classes, either by having them as afternoon classes or tutorials or independent studies. And my senior year and the summer after that year, after my junior year, I found a bunch of people who were running a camp for chronic schizophrenics out on Cape Cod. And we took 43 patients out of Boston State Hospital with an average stay of 12 years and put them one-on-one with college students in an abandoned farm, as I say, on Cape Cod. I was the program director of that. What a phenomenal experience for a kid. That year, I was a junior in college. I taught full-time and dealt with these kids' work as well as their lives. And then that summer, dealt with these mental patients. It was just a phenomenal, as I say, opportunity to learn a lot and grow up. My senior year, I was going to do a thesis, and I got as my tutor John Holt, who had written How Children Learn and How Children Fail and was one of the leaders of the sort of new education movement at the time. He was doing a year at Harvard. I got him as my tutor. He heard my proposal, read it. He said, "That's very nice, but wouldn't you rather do something?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, I've met these 29 kids who have been suspended from this new supposedly alternative private school, and I think you should meet with them." And I met with them and their parents, and we ended up starting our own school, which only lasted 4 years, but that first year we were creating it. The second year, the first year after my graduation, I was the director of that school. I obviously had some entrepreneurial sense, and I was willing to take on risks, but the opportunities were phenomenal.
And what would you say was the most important thing you took away from those experiences, both starting and working in schools and with the mentally ill?
Wow. I think probably it was the sense of listening to people and realizing that we're not all that different. I remember my experiences with these chronic schizophrenics with years of being locked up and getting massive amounts of Thorazine and that sort of thing. And as people know, mental hospitals, if they've seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
like that.
Yeah, that's kind of what it was like. I would say to them, "Oh, come on. You know, I'm crazy too, but I'm just not going to let them lock me up." And that was really pretty much my attitude, was that given what society's norms was, I was crazy, you know, or considered, you know, certainly not the norm. And with the students, I found that, you know, that if you could really get sort of a little bit I noticed that my classes were a little more emotional than the other classes. I don't think my discipline was as strong. I was 19. Some of the kids were 18. You know, that's no, you know. But they did very well. Their test scores all went up. Mm-hmm. And I think there was something about, you know, I found
having
a way
been
to
listen to so closely.
That and dealing with the whole person, not just, you know, this is who you are. I think those things have stuck with me forever. And I will say that one of the ways I describe what I do on this show is that I teach through learning, or I learn through teaching. I'm not sure what it is, but when I'm interviewing on this show, I'm still in the somewhat that same old role of teaching and learning at the same time, which is what I did then. And I think I tried in my first few shows here, I inherited this show from a stand-up, and he would just pick a subject and kind of riff on it. And I tried to do his format, and I couldn't do it. And that's when I learned that it had to be interesting to me, I think, for it to sound interesting to anyone else. And the way that I did that was to pick things I wanted to learn about.
Great. So then in your life, you've made a lot of abrupt turns. And from all of this teaching and working with the mentally ill, and I know you lived communally for a while with people and experimented that way, and then you went out to California to become an actor. What caused that turn?
Well, I didn't come out here to become an actor, actually. I came out here first time I was here in 72 when I worked for McGovern. I actually
McGovern was running for president.
Running for president in 72, and I was given the job of running an assembly district in Los Angeles, and it was the most conservative Democratic assembly district. That is, not the most conservative, but the most conservative Democratic one. It was, for people who live in L.A., it was Bell Gardens, Cudahy, Maywood, Huntington Park, Linwood, Downey. It was, you know, it was working class. It was white, just beginning to, it's interesting, it was beginning to go Latino. And a lot of that part of the county has become Latino over the years. But the union folks, who would have been the strong Democratic backers, they couldn't stand McGovern because he'd beaten Hubert Humphrey, who was their hero. And so it was really a tough thing. But I did that, and then I said, "Oh, when we lost 49-1, if people don't remember, Nixon beat McGovern 49-1, and me and my workers in 49 states to 1. We sat in our, you know, office where we were watching the returns and just cried. And then I said, "Oh well, I guess politics doesn't work." And I went back to Cambridge actually and learned video documentary. And Portapax had just come out. That is, portable video machines had just come out within 6 months. And I got one of those, and I decided I would make video documentaries. And the first gig I got was to come back to L.A. and make one about Buckminster Fuller.
And for people who don't who are young, what was he about?
Buckminster Fuller was certainly a genius, certainly a misfit, an inventor, a philosopher. He predated the environmental movement by years, but he was the one who said there's enough to go around if we weren't hamstrung by politics and economics, if we really were trying to spread the wealth to all. He also said that information is the only thing that when you add to it, you don't subtract, you know, that no one loses when we add to the information. He was way ahead of his time.
Documentary.
Yeah. Then I made two or three more, but there was one night I can tell you, I was, here's another thing. At that point, I was living in my van. Yep. I often say that today I would be described as homeless. I just thought I was free, you know. But I was. I was living in my van, and SciArc, the Southern California Institute of Architecture, which was a very radically new institution, allowed me to park my van outside and use their kitchen and their bathroom and stuff because the video public access project of the cable station was there. So I would work during the day at the cable public access, helping people do public access shows, and then at night I'd edit my documentaries. And one night I just realized I was incredibly lonely. And I said, this is crazy. You know, I'm not making any friends. I'm doing this. And I said, when did I have the most fun in college? And I realized the time I'd had the most fun was when I was acting in plays, hanging out with theater people, funny sort of improv kind of folks. And I decided before I left L.A., which was basically my feeling at that point, I would just give the entertainment industry a stab. And I will tell you one other thing that happened was I was watching a video that I had shot of this workshop with the Buckminster Fuller and his ideas and stuff. And at a couple of points, I was in the shot. I was in the discussion rather than shooting. And I thought, you know, I look fine there. I got a pretty good energy. I could maybe be an actor.
And I want to say at this point, a lot of your listeners probably don't know what you look like. You have always been exceptionally attractive. You looked like you then, and still now, you were distinctively attractive. You looked at the time I met you, which was in the 70s,
yeah,
like you could be a movie star.
Yeah.
And so, you had that charisma, that energy as well.
Yeah, so I figured, you know, give it a shot. And I didn't know that normally people took one acting class and they had their teacher, you know. So I immediately enrolled in three different acting classes. So I was still editing my videos, but I was going to three acting classes and rehearsing, and I just jumped into it with both feet. And that someone that I was working with in one of my classes said, have you ever heard of the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco? I'm going to go there to their summer program. Check it out. So I did. I auditioned. I got in. I got a scholarship. So I went and I did a year at ACT and then came back to L.A. And I was an actor. And it was – this is the strange part. I chose it because I was lonely, but then I stuck to it because at age 26, I said, I've done teaching, I've done politics, I've done mental health, I've done documentaries, all these things. I haven't stuck to anything. I'd better stick to something. And I decided I would stick to what I was doing then, which was acting. I don't think that was a smart choice necessarily.
Because?
Well, because because
it's incredibly tough.
Looking back, I didn't make what I wanted to make of my acting career. And the other piece of it was that it is such a passive, thing. You do your best and hope they pick you.
Yes, I was going to say an actor, because I was in the TV business for 25 years, writing and producing drama shows, and I saw that an actor eats rejection for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You audition, and if you don't have the exact look they want, you don't even have a chance. And you're constantly being told, no, no, no. How did you handle that?
Well, I think I handled it pretty well, and I'm not sure why. But I'm not sure that that handling that well bodes well after you stop acting, because I think to some extent, you know, you get inured to rejection. And I don't know. I mean, there's some parts where I still think I'm doing this radio show waiting to be discovered. And after 17 years, that may not be such a smart strategy, which is one reason I'm taking the hiatus. But I think I dealt with it fairly well. In other words, an awful lot of people who are actors from 10 years old, 12 years old. You know, they play the lead part in the school play, and then they
right.
do. And I had lived. I didn't decide to act until I was 26, which isn't old, but I'd had, as we've spent a lot of minutes talking about, I'd had a lot of ambition, a lot of accomplishment, a lot of adventures, a lot of testing prior to becoming an actor. And so I think I knew I was okay, even when I was rejected. Now, that didn't pay the bills, and that didn't make me – I mean, one of the reasons I got into acting, in addition to just I'm going to stick with the thing I'm doing, was I saw the platform that it could have. And I think my goal was as much to be a great actor as to get the kind of platform that a popular actor can use – the way, whether
speak
it's
out,
Ted
maybe.
Danson or George Clooney or, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of them use it to as a bully pulpit to do a lot of good. And I think that was part of the attraction for me.
Yes. In addition to working as an actor, you also wrote a screenplay, you produced records, books, music. What was the high point of working in what in L.A. we call the biz, the entertainment business?
Yeah.
For you.
Let me see. Before I answer that, let me tell people that voice is Sarah Davidson, the best-selling author of Loose Change and Leap, whose new book, The December Project, comes out near the end of March. And today I've turned the tables, and Sarah is interviewing me.
Not an easy job, I would say.
Yeah, after 17 years, I've turned it around. And you can learn more about Sarah's work at sarahdavidson.com and about my stuff at terrencemcnally.net or worldatjustmightwork.com. Well, that was my salvation, really. I had the 7 years where I was only acting. I did plays on a regular basis, and I took classes, and I auditioned, and I made a living. I made a living, which is some people will say, if you make a living for 15, 20 years as an actor, you know, people don't know what a great achievement that is, but it's not necessarily fulfilling. But I was taking improv classes and met another improv, in my improv class, a woman named Julie Brown, who was doing stand-up at the time, and we started dating, and one day we started writing along with her writing partner, Charlie Coffey. She said, I think I'm going to put music in my act. That was when Valley Girl was popular.
And Valley Girl was the what?
Moon Zappa's song, which was really kind of, I think nowadays it would be called a rap, but it was basically she was talking about what it was like to be a Valley Girl. And so Julie was a Valley Girl as well, and she said, I think I'm going to put music in my act. And I was making enough money as an actor that I actually had a little bit to spend just in the insanity of it all. My biggest source of income back then at that moment was that I was the spokesman for Bacardi Rum in Mexico. You know this, Sarah. I neither drink nor speak Spanish. So, but for 5 years, I was the television image of Bacardi in Mexico. And if anybody saw the movie Lost in Translation with Bill Murray, basically what he was in Japan, I was in Mexico. But I had enough money that I said, okay, I want to produce this stuff. And we had a vision, and it was if we can produce songs that are really good. This is 82, 83. This is just the birth of MTV, and we can make videos that are really good. Okay. Then we can probably make movies. And so it was now for both of us, it was her path. For her to become a star, I think it was her path to that. And for me, it was my path to become a director. And so we did produce and write, she and I and Charlie, records that we did an EP, five-song EP that was, in answer to one of your questions, I think, which was what was the high point, that was the most fun. The most fun was producing records and music videos. That was partially it was the closest I came to being the director. You know, the producer of a record is the director, and I was the director of the music videos. And that was just, it was such a high. And then it led to Earth Girls Are Easy, the movie, which included the songs and was meant to be the first of several musicals. But by the time the movie premiered, we had separated, and that writing and producing partnership was long gone.
So what was your next focus? Because you did decide to leave acting and the entertainment.
Right. Business. Over the next few years after that, I couldn't get arrested with my own screenplays. They'd go, but where's the Kooky Valley thing? You know, and I'd go, well, this is a script I like. And, you know, I did nothing. I had I found a writing partner at that point, you know, that fork in the road might have been different. But I continued to act and make a living, but I realized this was not the vision that I had hoped for. And I've said it before. In 1989, my 20th Harvard reunion, I went back there, and Earth Girls Are Easy was playing at the Harvard Square Theater that week. I think it only played for a week, but it was there. And I was a regular that year on Knott's Landing. So it was like, wow, I've made it. And I asked the reunion folks, what were we going to do to commemorate our earlier ideals and so on? And they said, well, nothing really. And I said, well, can I make a speech? And they said, do you want to make a speech? And I said, sure. So I made a speech in which I questioned, and this is 89, how were we living up to our ideals? And I basically, if you go back and read that speech, it basically sets up this radio show. It sets up sort of everything I've been doing, because it said that we face a lot of crises, and the environmental ones seem to be the biggest, but the environmental area that most needs change is not the water or the air, it's our minds, and that we've got to change our consciousness to look at the big picture and all that stuff I said at the start of the show. And when I came back, as I say, I don't know whether it changed anyone else's life, but that speech changed mine, and I sought out some nonprofit groups in Hollywood, got involved with an environmental organization, an education organization, and then found that what I'd been so good at as a young person, working with those mental patients, working with those students and so on, was I could hear what I could understand and almost restate what people wanted and was thinking better than they could. And so I offered myself as someone who would facilitate board retreats of nonprofits, strategic planning processes. And I did that for a few years and kind of began to build up a career in that vein as my Hollywood career was dying down. And then saw that to really make a go of it on that as a consultant to nonprofits and foundations, I decided I would focus on communication, where I could use everything I'd learned in the entertainment industry. So my work primarily over the last 5 years is working with organizations on storytelling and narrative, and so it really does use everything that I used as a teacher, as a writer, as a director, as a producer, you know, all, as an actor. All of that is what you realize. Everything in entertainment is based on story.
Yes, and I believe that people learn more through story than they do by reading philosophical or political text.
Or data.
Yes.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Now, when you pair the two of them, the people who are great speakers, for instance, and great writers in terms of getting their point across, usually pair the story and the lesson, the data
and the lesson.
Yeah, but the lesson
comes through the story.
Exactly.
That's how you hook people.
Exactly. Although you know, Ira Glass's This American Life story, every one of them, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, this is what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah.
So let's talk about your radio show. You've been doing it for quite a while now. And I want to ask you, what was the most memorable person you interviewed? I know there were many, but what is the first one that just pops in your mind?
Okay, the one that I often say, and it was Wael Ghanim, the Google exec who started the Facebook page We Are All Khalid, that had a great deal to do with the Tahrir Square uprisings. He was live here. I'm sitting in a studio in Los Angeles talking to someone who a year before hadn't even dreamed of what he would do, who then took one hesitant action after another and ended up creating this amazing shift, which, you know, hasn't turned out perfectly by any means, but just unraveling that story, I remember, it just felt like what a gift to be able to be part of that. And I will say this, though. A few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, I interviewed the three of the filmmakers of The Square.
Yes.
The documentary that, if anyone hasn't seen it, make sure you see it, and hopefully it wins the Academy Award, although there were other great documentaries up this year. But I had the director, the producer, and one of the participants in here, the three of them. And that was a magical interview. It's going to be at Alternate soon, but the three of them said after that interview they learned things about each other that they didn't know. So something about being that close to events that change history, I think, is what makes it seem. Now, I've had wonderful interviews, you know, with other people, but there's something about being right on the edge of, you know, world-changing events that just was incredibly exciting for me.
Yes. I want to ask you the question that you ask many of your guests.
Yeah.
if you could stand in the future, say 30 years from now, did humanity turn things around, or did we continue raping and pillaging the earth? And if the world is better than it from in that 30 years from now, how did we do it?
Well, when I first came up with that question, and any time I ask it, I always think that it basically goes this way. If you answer no, then you've got to live with that. If you answer yes, then you've got to tell me how you think it happened. I can't answer no. There's something in my makeup that just doesn't do that. I don't know whether it's actually what we would call optimism, but I do. I am a glass half empty, I mean, half full person. See, but to me, actually, they're both fine. Empty, half full, they're the same, you know. That I do just feel like, okay, today we do this, tomorrow we do, you know, it's like, let's go with it. So I do believe, I do have to say we will turn it around, although I'd say it's probably 51-49. Now, if I have to answer how, again, I go back to what I said in 1989 in that speech. I think it's going to happen in our consciousness, although I think that for us to turn things around, it's going to take technology as well. In other words, I think this is not one. See, to change civil rights, for instance, or justice on certain ways, you have to change the way people think and the way they behave. But to deal with climate change and some of the other things that we've set in motion here, we're going to have to get lucky technologically as well. But I think the big change will be, again, I tell people, now you're standing in the future, you're telling us how it happened. And I guess if I had to do that, and I've got about a minute and a half to do that, I would say that the internet probably had a hand in it, that as young people especially grew up feeling more connected to the rest of the globe, even if, you know, we look at them and see them just sitting on their screen and wonder why they're not even connected with people in the room. I do think this sense of being connected to the rest of the world, of information being at your fingertips, which means that if someone tells you one thing, you can find out the different point of view, you know, no matter where you are. And the sharing economy, which is beginning to happen, where people, young people, are not as anxious. It's driving some, you know, in the CEO offices crazy, but they're not as interested in buying cars. They're not as interested in buying houses. They're not as interested in owning things as they are having experiences and sharing. In other words, if I can get a car now and then, that's all I need. I think these kinds of shifts in the developed world are going to make a difference. And I think in the developing world, I think they're going to leapfrog us in ways that technology, they will never have to go through some of the phases we went through, because technology will arrive there cleaner, smaller, faster. Yes?
So, Terrence, what's next for you? You say hiatus. That implies a break, not leaving.
Right. What happened that made this hiatus imminent was a situation that's always been true, which is that I do this show pro bono, as do most of the folks on KPFK and Pacifica. It means you need a margin. I think it usually takes about 2 days a week in terms of booking and producing and hosting and researching and promoting and all of that. To do that, you got to have a margin. And my margin has been through my work with nonprofits and foundations for the last few years. I suffered a staph infection in my knee this summer. I couldn't work or do anything basically for about 3 months. And my margin was eaten up. And I just saw, wait a minute. And I'm not as young as I used to be. I looked forward at, you know, I'm 65. I looked, you know, I've got 5 years for sure where hopefully I'll be, you know, setting myself up for the rest of my life. But the staph infection says you are vulnerable. Anything could happen. I had a cardiac episode in the middle of that where I almost died on the table that we don't know why it happened. But boy, that suddenly is not just I'm vulnerable, but I could be gone any moment. And I just realized that as much as I love this show, I really love it. I hope it's valuable. I hope it has impact. I can't afford to do it. I don't have those 2 days margin. So I've got to take the time out to establish a new model. My goal, my hope would be, because I love this work, would be that I can find a way to support this and do whatever work I've got to do, or, you know, as my cleaning lady says, thanks God, you know, someone comes along and I find a source of support that means I could do radio or television interviewing full time. I would love that. But at this moment, I've got to focus. I can't afford to put the time in putting on this show each week. I've got to focus on how I'm going to make the best of my life for the next few years.
Well, I'm going to stand for the possibility, in fact, the reality that that is going to happen. Thank you, Terrence. I've learned more about you in this hour than in the 30-plus years I've known you.
Well, that's a good thing, I think, and so have other people. Thank you so much, Sarah. I know this was when I thought about doing this show, I thought immediately of asking you to do it, and it's been wonderful, and I really appreciate it.
It's an honor.
Great. Sarah's next book is The December Project, An Extraordinary Rabbi and a Skeptical Seeker. It comes out in March. To learn more, go to sarahdavidson.com. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a few articles of background, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.